cigarettes and the ghetto's play. Long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile again. Rise above the pain. This is for you and your crew, the ones that's true will always love you no matter what you do.
Rise is the light, the light, the light, the light, the light. Rise the light, the light, the light.
Welcome to Spitfire, Women of Color Radio, every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are live in studio with Spitfire hosts Mercedes, Victoria, Simi, and Lily, and welcoming Tamara as well today.
Hi.
Today we hold space for Palestinians whose lives are threatened by the ongoing siege in Gaza and the latest Israeli military operation, My Brother's Keeper. Gaza is the world's largest open-air prison, where some 1.5 million people on a roughly 140-square-mile strip of land are subject to random terror and arbitrary punishment with no purpose other than to humiliate and degrade. We have assembled some voices of Palestinian women speaking in resistance to the occupation of Palestine and the ongoing assault on Palestinians by Israel in the name of Zionism. We also have in studio today Montreal actress, singer, director, writer, and educator, Tamara Brown. Welcome to the studio, Tamara.
Hello.
We're really excited to have you. We'll be talking to her about her work as the co-founder of Metachroma Theater in 2010, an independent theater company with the mandate of normalizing the presence of visible minority artists on stage.
Mercedes brings us the latest on the departure of Zendaya Coleman from the Lifetime Network's biopic of Aaliyah. This is the latest in a series of controversial biopics of black cultural icons. Is Hollywood whitewashing our singers?
Sydney breaks down the reaction to Sierra Mani's article, Dear White Gays, Stop Stealing Black Female Culture, where Mani critiques the growing cultural practice of some gay white men flaunting the markers of stereotyped black womanhood. What do we think about this alleged solidarity between bougie white gay men and black women?
All that and more coming up right now on Spitfire Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM.
تحاصرني مرايا الروح وأنا أرحل مني إليك تحاصرني مرايا الروح وأنا أرحل مني إليه ومن فضائي إلى أفق الأقحوان أترقرق توهجا فوق عوسج الجدران تسربلني النوارس وتعبر بي مني إليه أينفي العدى الحنين في الخبايا خذني إليه فأنا الرمق الأخير يشتعل في صمت الحنايا ويمتد مني إليه إلي ويمتد مني
That was Rim Bana, The Mirrors of My Soul. Rim Bana is a Palestinian artist, composer, and singer who lives in Nazareth. Her music and poetry illuminates the plight of Palestinians, especially those in the West Bank. She describes her music as a means of cultural self-assertion. We are broadcasting live in Montreal. It is now 6:06.
We're going to go now to an assemblage of some voices of Palestinian women speaking in resistance to the occupation of Palestine and the ongoing assault on Palestinians by Israel.
What's happening right now amounts to a massacre. It is not a war, and we should all be concerned.
When you look at the death toll and you see the numbers, then the numbers actually speak volumes. When you see that 80% of the people who have been killed are civilian, when you see that half of them are women and children, and when you see that who they're actually bombing is a population, 43% of whom are under the age of 14, then it's very easy to pierce through the propaganda. But more importantly, I think it's important to keep in mind that when Israel talks about who it's targeting, what it's targeting, they've never proffered any proof or any evidence for what it is that they're trying to hit. They simply make these allegations, and networks like Fox take it in and simply accept it as being fact. But the fact of the matter is that when all of this is over, Israel has never allowed independent investigators to come in and see what it is that Israel's doing. At the end of the day, as much as Israel tries to claim that they're not targeting civilians, they are, and the casualties speak volumes.
I don't like to talk much about numbers because you have, although numbers are very important, but I would like to give a message to the world that we are not just numbers. We are human beings with stories, dreams, anger, laughter, and everything. And Israel tried to portray the story to the world that it is defending Israel from the Hamas militants. Just let me explain that Hamas was democratically elected in the year 2007. So in any place of Gaza, you'll find hospitals, banks, streets, institutions belong to Hamas. That means that Israel is trying to destroy Gaza as a whole. Hamas is not just about the military wing of Hamas that is exchanging rockets with Israel. There is a population, 1.8 population, under very savage attack, and we hardly sleep. Not only as health workers, I mean the population, the whole population are not sleeping because of the intensity of the attacks.
Part of the debate of any media in the liberal democratic landscape is to discuss our own flaws as well as others, not only Bridgegate, but also Mediagate, I would say, and media scandal regarding the bias covering of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And I looked at studies, and the studies that were made by many scholars, respected American scholars, Juan Call and others, who are referring to the covering of the media, how much airtime is giving to the Israeli officials and how much airtime is giving to the Palestinian officials. And it's a U.S. landscape that is so biased. So, for example, in 2012, you had on CNN alone 45 Israeli officials interviewed versus 11 Palestinians. And when it comes to this conflict today, in 2014, you have 17 Israeli politicians, official interviewed, versus one Palestinian. So we are going backwards regarding this issue. And that forms and shapes the public opinion in America that then transfer and become political support unconditional to Israel, to a policy that is very destructive both to the Israelis and to American stance in the world.
It's important to keep in mind exactly what we're talking about here in the Gaza Strip. This is a place that is twice the size of D.C., Washington, D.C., and it's got 1.8 million people in it. Half of the population is under the age of 18. As I said, 43% is under the age of 14. If you were age 7 at this point in time, you've been through three bombing campaigns by the Israelis. So at the end of the day, as much as the Israelis want to claim that they're using this target precision devices, etc., the toll is really being taken out on Palestinian civilians. So far to date, the Israelis have dropped more weaponry and more bombings than over the three-week campaign that took place in 2009. They've admittedly dropped more than 800 tons of bombs on the Gaza Strip.
I'm very angry, very appalled, and more attacks by Israel will generate more hatred, more bitterness, and it will never guarantee peace.
What we need to ask, are we really guaranteeing, by supporting unconditionally this Israeli government, right-wing government, are we really helping Israel being more secure in the long term, and ultimately American interest and stand in the world? What we are doing in the media, we're portraying actually a false image where what's happening in Israel, and if you ask anybody, whether in New York, in D.C., in other places, what do you think is happening? They will tell you, well, Israel was minding its own business. The Palestinians start shooting missiles out of the blue. This is not the reality. This is not what's going on. And the context of this is what's leading the public opinion to support unconditionally Israel. And politicians will do what's popular, not what's right. We need to do what's right. We in the media have a mission, whether it's MSNBC, Democracy Now!, CNN. We have a mission. We're truth tellers, and we can shape public opinion to protect public interest.
Israel will claim that it has the right to self-defense, but an occupying power does not have the right to self-defense. It has an obligation and a duty to protect the civilians under its occupation. Even if it fails to meet that duty, it must abide by humanitarian law, principles of distinction, proportionality, of necessity. It has not abided by any of those. What's happening in Gaza amounts to war crimes. It's a repeat of what happened in 2008 and 2009. It's a repeat of what happened in 2012. Unfortunately, we can see this repeated again unless Israel is held to account under international humanitarian law mechanisms, under international criminal law, under sanctions by other governments in order to stop these massacres, not just now, but in the long run. And more importantly than that, to address the root causes of these flare-ups or symptoms of a much deeper problem, which is the structural violence of occupation, of a apartheid and of settler colonialism.
That was Palestinian human rights attorney Noura Arakat. Also, Dr. Mona El-Farrar, director of Gaza Projects for the Middle East Children's Alliance and health chair of the Palestinian Red Crescent Society of the Gaza Strip. You also heard one of MSNBC's frequent contributors, Rula Jibril, on the exclusion of Palestinian voices in the American news media, and Palestinian attorney Diana Boutu, who has served as a legal advisor to the Palestinians in negotiations with Israel and to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. This is Spitfire, Women of Color Radio, rebroadcasting Palestinian voices on the ongoing siege of Gaza from Democracy Now! You can find the full interviews on democracynow.org. As of today, the death toll amounts to over 1,200 Palestinians. We at Spitfire Women of Color Radio are sending our prayers and solidarity to our sisters and brothers in Gaza.
Mm-hmm. Now moving on to a topic we seem to talk about a lot on the show, which is social media activism. The good, the bad, and the really ugly. So we're talking about cyberbullying, assault, and revictimization. Jada, a 16-year-old from Houston, Texas, went to a house party where she was offered a drink by the host. Here she passed out, was stripped naked, and allegedly raped. She remembered nothing of the incident after passing out, but woke up to pictures of herself bottomless, unconscious, and splayed out on the floor, plastered all over social media. Other teens then started mocking and mimicking her pose while she was passed out, partially undressed, and had just been seemingly assaulted, captioning it with the hashtag Jada Pose. Since then, Jada has appeared on the local news and identified herself on social media with the I Am Jada hashtag, and also to tell her side of the story. A groundswell of support has risen up behind her. Women and men have been posing pictures on social media in a show of solidarity with Jada, raising their fists and holding signs as she did in a picture with the hashtag I Am Jada. They also appear under hashtags such as Stand With Jada, Justice For Jada, and Jada Counterpose, and demand a change in rape culture, education, as well as for arrests to be made in Jada's case. In an exclusive interview with Ronan Farrow, Jada's mother, Sukeda, and the family spokesperson, Quenelle X, gave further details on the case. According to Quenelle X, even though the police are investigating the alleged drugging and sexual assault of Jada, supporters of the perpetrators are continuing to cyberbully her. Furthermore, a Houston area rap artist has already written a song that riffs on the Jada Pose hashtag. As well, in a disturbing turn of events, investigations reveal that Jada is not the only one. According to the family spokesperson, there are other young girls who they've been posting pictures online, having sex with these young girls, also who are comatose and obviously unconscious. And so the police are now putting out a call to identify who are these girls, who these videos and pictures by these alleged perpetrators are out there online. And they're having sex with these girls who are obviously unconscious. But through all the shaming and cyberbullying, Jada's voice remains strong and clear. So let's hear a little from her in this exclusive interview she granted to KHUO News.
Very brave teenager who's telling her story only to those who watch KHOU 11 News. She says that she was drugged and raped at a party, but the attack didn't stop there. In fact, someone took photos of her, then they posted them online. She says that they quickly went viral. So now she's going public to warn others. Here's our Rux Russell.
When they got into the car, it was like, come on, Jada, let's go. Come with us.
It seemed harmless enough, an impromptu invite to the home of a friend of a friend, the kind of thing high school kids do all the time.
Kids hanging out.
But for 16-year-old Jada.
And I just got swooped into
what happened behind these walls.
I wasn't supposed to be there.
Became a nightmare.
I had no control to say no. I didn't tell anyone to take my clothes off and do what they did to me.
Jada says the teenage boy hosting the gathering offered her a drink of punch. She believes he spiked it with a drug. She says she passed out and had no clue what had happened until disturbing tweets, pictures, and videos started to appear on social media. Jada says she was raped that night. We blurred the images, but kids have been sharing them over their cell phones.
And everybody's texting me, are you okay? It's okay, Jada. You're going to be okay. And I'm just like, all right, thanks.
Houston police are investigating Jada's claims. Her mom asked not to be identified.
No one's daughter deserves this. No human being deserves this.
Reputation, that's over. She's done with it.
In a way, it's as though she's been assaulted twice, both here and online. And even though it's our policy not to identify rape victims, Jada refused to hide.
It's no point in hiding. Because the picture, well, everybody already seen my face and my body, but that's not what I am and who I am.
Who she is.
I'm just angry.
A young girl haunted by the reminders.
I don't care.
And in pain. And Jada tells me because of all of this, she wants to be homeschooled for a while. She also wants to see her alleged attackers brought to justice.
Hello. This is Amita Claudine Maris. Whenever I'm in Montreal, I like to listen to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal.
We have to speak our truth and to say no to the silencing of our voices in a racist and sexist society.
Spoken word.
interview.
What's that?
Hot.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal.
Tune in to Spitfire every last Wednesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. on 90.3 FM CKUT Radio.
To Spitfire Radio. That was Oh Mama, the Breeze Bends by Nahr Barghouti. Nahr Barghouti is a Palestinian singer, composer, and flutist. The time is 6:23 and it's 23 degrees out. Thanks, Ali. Turning now to an exclusive interview in studio with Montreal actress, singer, director, writer, and educator, Tamara.
I'll take it.
Welcome, Tamara. Thank you for joining us today.
I'm fired up to be here. Oh, I love being around smart women. This is pretty awesome. I'm not casting aspersions on any of the women I know. It's just especially delicious. This is great, y'all.
Amazing. Thanks so much for joining us. Why don't you give our audience just a more personal sort of like bio of like, you know, what you're up to, what you're all about. I know you, like, that's why you're here, but...
Yeah. Well, I'm an actress. I guess my artistic career started in acting and primarily in theater, and that branched out into dance and into music and singing and writing, and performing spoken word poetry and writing plays and directing theater and branching out into TV and stuff like that. It's been an interesting ride. I think what I found was initially the acting that I really loved to do was somewhat limiting in terms of what I would get to play. And coming around to a way of thinking like, well, as the person being hired, I'm not really in control of what I get to play. And so then I started to look into the ways that how do I get to shape the narrative and create things that I think are worthwhile doing, which all leads me to here and now. And also, it's really hard to make a living as an actor. You have to hustle, 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 and do a lot of different things to not be homeless. And so there's that as well.
Do you want to, like, I know you were telling me the other night about your theater company. Like, do you want to tell me a little bit about the Metachroma Theater?
Yeah, absolutely. So Metachroma Theater was it's an independent theater company that was created in 2010 with seven other professional actors of color. It's a Montreal-based company, although two of our members are also in Toronto. We created the company. It came out of a lot of discussions and a lot of conversations together. We've all been very fortunate to have a lot of opportunities to work and to perform in theater general, but what we observed was that we didn't often get to work together. What would happen often, it was like, oh, yay, girl, you got that job. That's so amazing. Good on you. Oh, right on. You're in that show. Woohoo, it's my turn. And realizing that if it was not under the guise of a very culturally specific project, mm-hmm. we just never had the opportunity to work together. You know, Black Theatre Workshop in town is an amazing company, and that's where I grew up, I'm always going to be grateful to them. And I mean, one of our members, one of our founders, it's Quincy Armour, and he's currently the artistic director of the company. Everybody's all over the place, and we have artistic directors and all kinds of cool stuff like that. But what we started to ask ourselves the question of why that was so, why we didn't often work together, and why the projects on which we worked inevitably had some kind of a cultural interpretation. If it was Shakespeare, it was Shakespeare set in Haiti or something. I'm pulling that completely out of my butt, but that's the kind of thing that happens. I mean, we can talk about, we've seen people do whatever to Shakespeare, for example, and we asked ourselves the question, well, why does that have to be the case? I mean, clearly, you know, based on Noah and Moses and these other, you know, there's no problem with race bending when it goes one direction, mm-hmm. but why is it an issue any other way? And so we created this company to basically tell stories without any particular racial or cultural drive, just to pick stories from the canon, stories that you know, and just honestly cast the best people for the role. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, in terms of casting, so often you see all ethnicities welcome. and so you do get called out to work, but what's interesting is the natures of the roles that you get called out to participate in. What is the latest one? Is it Noah? It's Moses. You Moses saw that. Christian. They're making a Moses movie. Bale. Did you see this on the...
to the Bible now? We're done with superheroes?
Apparently so.
He looks like a gladiator, though.
What?
He looks like a gladiator, and I think he wears a loincloth.
And it's, you know, it's pretty telling. I mean, on social media, there's this picture, you know, where you see all of the nobility are all of these, you know, American and British and Australian... read white superstars playing the main characters, and the villains and the slaves are African. And so we had our inaugural production of Richard III, and we just decided, how about we just do some Shakespeare, set it in the time, and just do the thing. Jamie, your mom is Julie. Julie is half Japanese, half British. So what? And, you know, and we had focus groups and conversations with the theater community at large and, you know, discussing this question about, okay, colorblindness. If you want to talk about colorblindness, we don't want you to erase our color. Who we are, who I am, I'm proud of who I am. And if your perception, if when you look at me, you infer certain things, well, that's your baggage to work with. And what can be done with the storytelling through that? Because I know for my part, what it meant to me when I began to see people of color on screen and the kinds of roles that they play. I mean, there's an erasure of the kinds of stories that you're allowed to tell. I mean, oh my goodness, I gave up acting a decade ago because I couldn't play another maid, single mother, or hooker again. I was just done. And then... yeah, it's an addiction, so I'm back in the acting thing. I have to do it. It's, when it's good, it's really good. When it's bad, it's still pretty good. And so what, you know, if you can imagine, if you could do, we chose Richard III as opposed to something like Midsummer Night's Dream, because, you know, if not fairies and such, why not kings and queens? What's the, mm-hmm. kings and queens, what's the, you know, what's the difference? So the where and why for of Metachroma. And it's funny, we created it because we didn't often get to work together, and then... after a really amazing first show, everybody immediately started working a ton. And actually getting everybody together to create a new season has proven challenging. But we hold firmly to work by consensus, which makes the decision-making process long, but you're much less likely to make a bad choice. So, yeah. why am I allowed to curse on the air? Why bitch about the status quo and when you can just take your own future into your hands? Done bitching about casting practices in North America. I'm done. We're done asking for handouts. If we don't like the narrative, it's time to change it. If you can't imagine something different, let's show you something different. And quite frankly, I think producers, and this is across the board, have so little confidence in their audiences. Mm. Like, for the longest, when are stories going to start reflecting the realities that we see around us? And it's starting to happen, I think, box office-wise. Lucy.
My favorite show.
Completely outperformed Hercules. Like, yay, another story of white men fighting, and oh, here's a women driven story, and that may bank, you know. I mean, Shonda Rhimes is gonna rule Thursday nights. All hail Empress Shonda. You know, I think that audiences that are less interested in theater and film and so on are looking for other story alternatives because it's getting boring. Why do we have to see the same things again and again? Why am I going to plunk down money for that? I'll play a video game when I can personalize my character instead and have a story that way. And I think we're losing out on something. You know, there's something great about getting together for theater or for film. There's something about that collective community thing of getting together and getting into a story, and who are you going to cheer on, and who are you going to hate on, and what are you going to talk about when it's all said and done?
Mm-hmm. So speaking of storytelling. I just, like, you were telling me last week when we met for dinner, how dinner. You're actually working on a piece of writing that's a little bit about not necessarily gender bending, but I guess like myth bending and adaptation. Do you want to tell us a bit about this work?
Yes. Last year, I was participating in a professional development program at Black Theatre Workshop, under a mentorship in playwriting, and I wrote a play called Sympathy for the Sea Witch, which is the story of the Little Mermaid as told by the sea witch's perspective.
Legit.
Yeah. See, because we've probably all seen the Disney version, and I read the Hans Christian Andersen version, and I guess the first question, what made me want to write, was that question of, where is this Little Mermaid's mother? Why don't... I had my issues with the Little Mermaid, like, I know what I'll do. I'll change everything about myself and give up my voice so that I can have a man. You know, those were things that I found problematic, and I guess I wanted to address it. When I took some time to dig into the story and who Hans Christian Andersen is, and realizing that he was in fact a queer writer, it made me think, like, my goodness, you know, just reading a bit about his story, so many stories of unrequited love, queer, bi. No disrespect to anybody, anywho, but I mean, a lot of his stories were, a lot of unrequited love stories, being in love with a woman who wouldn't love him back, or a man who wouldn't love him back. And I asked myself the question, gosh, would he have been so hard on this poor Little Mermaid, who didn't get the man, by the way, who, like, straight up died. You know, it's just like, my goodness, would he have been so hard on her if he was, like, okay about accepting, you know, like, about who he wanted to love in a society. And when we look at fairy tales anyways, that used to be the domain of women. That was women telling stories to each other. And, you know, our fellas, the Grimm brothers and Hans and the Perots, co-opt that stuff and frame it in a Christian light, and to, you know, repackage these stories and teach morality to children. And I don't know, I kind of always have been grieved about how strong women in fairy tales tend to not have names or be labeled as witches. And then when I looked at the actual dialogue that the witch had to say to the Little Mermaid, I didn't think she was that mean. Like, I thought that she was just talking about consequences. Well, this is what you want, but it's kind of stupid. It's going to hurt. It's going to be this and it's going to be that. And what was interesting was how the author had framed the way that she spoke, that she cackled, that she was ugly, and she was this, and then I was like, Can we cut this poor woman a break, you know? Like, I mean, I know being old might be scary, you know, sorry that I'm not fuckable and sorry that I have a voice of my own, but maybe there's wisdom to to still take from this woman. So I imagined, bang, what if, you know, the sea witch was actually the Little Mermaid's mom? Oh, did I just reveal the punch? Shoot. It's still worth coming to see this play. It's still worth coming to see this play when it goes up. Listen, you heard it here first. I totally revealed the twist.
Tamara Brown, thank you so much for joining us on Spitfire. I just wanted to ask you before we go to musical break, where are we going to see this play? Where am I going to read it? Like, you know, what's coming up?
This coming season, I'm very excited to be the director in residence at Black Theater Workshop. So I'm going to be busy doing a whole bunch of directing. Hooray!
Cool.
No bitching about status quo. Let's tell those stories. Let's cast those people. But that's what I'm going to be doing over the course of this year, and continuing to work and develop that play through with Playwrights Workshop and then pitch it to the companies, and whoever gets there first wins.
Okay, well, I was just been notified by our lovely tech person, Lily, over here, that we have 5 more minutes to just chill and chat.
Oh, awesome.
So I actually had another question. I'm going to open it up to everybody in the room, giving you the floor first, Mara. We've been talking a lot about visual culture recently over the last few months, and we always go back to this conversation that Bell Hooks had with a number of really smart women at the New School in the spring, and she basically referred to Beyonce as a terrorist, as a form of supporting patriarchal terrorism on the minds of, like, you know, young black girls. In her depiction of the female black body. So just because you're an actress, I know you do a little bit of miking for a burlesque show, you know.
Doing a Beyonce show this very weekend, as it turns out.
Okay, tell us about it. Tell us about it.
I'm hosting Beyonce night at the Wiggle Room on Saturday, you know, singing and doing stand-up. Well, my character's a bit bitter about Beyonce, but, you know, her story is that she was originally in Destiny's Child, and it all went to shit when Beyonce's like, well, my mom could do the costumes and my dad could, like, be the manager. And then and then poor Beneatha got shut out. But, oh, my word, poor bae. Why do we hate on... We're so hard on each other. Oh, my goodness, can we just stop bringing each other down as it is? It's like, I love me some Bell Hooks. I adore her. She's like my hero. She's every inch the educator and the woman I would like to be, in the force for good and for sanity and being articulate. I gotta say, I think Harry Belafonte spoke to the fact that there's a diminishing of leadership in black celebrity and an advocacy for civil action that I think is interesting. I think now the narrative's become about, you know, who's made it through, like a Oprah and hooray Barack Obama and hooray Jay and Bay, and, you know, you can make it, you see. And it's just like, yeah, but that's not everybody. Right. And there used to be, you know, I think there was maybe it happened sometime in the 80s or something, that idea of, you know, what we can do collectively for each other and our well-being, continuing to push for those civil rights. I think that has fallen down. I think there's a legitimate criticism about, you know, what can we do to keep pushing through legislation beyond, you know, showing prosperity, which is important, right?
Right, and use, like, your celebrity platform.
Absolutely. I mean, to counter the negative images of an affluent woman and, you know, in a marriage that's happy or not, whatever, it's not my business. But you know, like, what that means to see this woman who is influential and rocking it and owning her sexuality, especially when you consider a history of how our bodies have been co-opted and abused and raped and such, you know, to see a woman go, like how Riri do. Really? I said it just like that? But like how Rihanna does, you know, in the same way of like, well, this is my body and I have agency, and it, too bad if you don't like it, because you can't actually... get next to me. But I don't know. Oh, Beyonce, Beyonce, Beyonce. You do you. Run your empire, girl. I'm not mad at you. If you want to sponsor my company, you can reach us at info@metachroma.com. But, you know, I don't know. That's just what I'm thinking about it lately. Mm-hmm. I'll probably change my mind.
Thanks so much, Tamara Brown. You're listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, only on CKUT 90.3 FM.
My ramble of the month is going to be about this Zendaya Coleman controversy and the Aaliyah biopic that's supposed to be coming out later on this year by Lifetime Network. So here I go. So movies are a great way to put the artistic vision someone has in motion. They allow the viewer to be part of the journey the visionary has mapped out for their characters. However, what happens when the movie and the characters within is based on someone's life? In other words, a biopic, a biography on film. How important is accuracy when it comes to recreating the person of interest's life? Must we as viewers be able to see the person come to life through the actor's mannerisms, speech, and physical appearance in order to believe that it is truly them? For some, it may be a trivial thing. As long as the story is consistent with actual facts and life events of a person's life, who cares who is acting out the life of another, or if there is any uncanny resemblance? For others, it's the principle of the thing, especially when it comes to people of color and film. I'm going out on a limb here, and I'm going to make a very broad statement. When it comes to white actors and actresses who participate in biopics, recreating the lives of other prominent white figures, i.e. Marilyn Monroe, John F. Kennedy, John Lennon, the list goes on, any actor or actress can play these individuals, just as long as there is some kind of physical resemblance. Everything such as hair color, weight, accents, and mannerisms are superficial and can be modified in some way through movie magic. But the thing that makes it easy enough for these white actresses and actors to get these roles with ease is the fact that they all have a similar skin tone. However, the same cannot be said for black actors and actresses. This is where things get a bit tricky. It seems when it comes to them, physical characteristics make the part. It is the most important aspect in terms of preserving both the actor's personhood and that of the role they are playing. But why does it become so important? Why does one measure quote-unquote blackness as a determinant of worthiness and acceptability to play a certain part? Why should we even care? Well, it's simple, of course. It's a matter of principle, it's a matter of accurate depiction, and it's a matter of respect for self. If white people can have their idols immortalized on film the way they want, then why can't the same courtesy be bestowed on people of color and their idols? Again, it's simple. With Hollywood, it is all about the visual. The visual of how they believe certain people should be represented and who will be representing them. We see this a lot in the media, specifically when it comes to women of color. The ideal of what a woman of color should look like, a Beyonce, an Alicia Keys, a Vivica A. Fox, or a Zoe Saldana, to name a few. But God forbid we be a Whoopi Goldberg, a Lauryn Hill, or even a Nina Simone. Now, the point of my piece is not to go on a tyrannical rant against Hollywood and white people, but to point out the ways in which biopics about women of color are often misrepresentative about who they are based on Hollywood's fantasy about how they should be reincarnated on the screen. It is not the first time that this has happened, and it won't be the last. I'd mentioned the names of Zoe Saldana and Nina Simone early on in the piece. I did so because Zoe Saldana was chosen as the actress to play Nina Simone in the biopic of her life. At first glance, you would think that it's no big deal. She is, after all, a woman of color. But it becomes a big deal when Zoe Saldana is nowhere close to looking like Nina Simone or encompassing what Nina Simone stood for. The fact that Saldana and Simone are different in terms of skin color, facial features, and aesthetic beauty overall puts into question why they would cast her in the first place. Furthermore, the fact that they had to put Zoe Saldana in blackface as an effort for her to resemble Nina Simone is indicative of how misrepresentative Hollywood is of women of color. Moving on to present-day North America, we see this issue arise with Zendaya Coleman and the Lifetime Network's production of an Aaliyah biopic. Coleman, who is biracial, was criticized as not being black enough to play the role of Aaliyah. When one looks at their pictures side by side, yes, the difference is noticeable. Zendaya is lighter than Aaliyah in complexion, but her facial features are similar, but still not the same. However, again, there's some resemblance in their physical appearance in terms of size, maybe height, and any other thing you want to notice. Although Coleman has backed out of the role, stating the reason why she chose not to do the Aaliyah movie had nothing to do with the haters or people telling her that she couldn't do it, or she wasn't talented enough or wasn't black enough, it had absolutely nothing to do with that. The main reason were the production value wasn't there, there were complications with the music rights, and she felt like it wasn't being handled delicately considering the situation. The one who was cast after her, however, is kind of different too, because she bears no resemblance to Aaliyah either. She's a little bit bigger in figure, her hair is curly, Aaliyah's was straight, yet they have similar skin tones, so at this point, what do we do now? Can we still cast her in the role of Aaliyah, or should we start finding someone else? Because women of color come in all different shapes, sizes, skin tones, you name it, we're not all the same. So when it comes to casting these actresses in these roles, where do we draw the line?
It's in. Mm-hmm. Yep. Dirty South. Can y'all really feel me? Feel us. East Coast, feel me. Feel us. West Coast, feel me. Say what? Dirty South. Here we go. Can y'all really feel me? Baby girl. East Coast, feel me. West Coast, feel me. Can you feel us? Dirty South. Dirty, dirty. Can y'all really feel me? Feel it. East Coast, feel me. Say what? West Coast, feel me. Dirty South. Dirty, dirty, dirty. Can y'all really feel me? I got pick a pick. East Coast, feel me.
Boy, I've been watching you like the hawk in the sky. You are my prey. Boy, I promise you, if we keep open heads, I know that one of these days we gon' hook it up while they talk on the phone. But see, I don't know if that's good. I've been holding back this secret from you. I probably shouldn't tell it. I'll be waiting there with my twins, my looks, my hat, just so I'm low-key. If you tell the world,
don't trip, you know that we'll be weak.
Oh boy, see I'm trusting you with my heart, my soul. I probably shouldn't let you. If I let this go.
That was Are You That Somebody by Aaliyah featuring Timberland. You're listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio every last Wednesday of the month on CQUT 90.3 FM at 6:49.
All right, so now to switch gears a little, I wanted to talk about the Sierra Mani opinion piece that appeared on Time Magazine Online. Sierra Manny is a senior majoring in classics and English at the University of Mississippi. She's a regular contributor to the opinion section of her school student newspaper called the Daily Mississippian, where the article originally appeared and then was reposted on the Time magazine blog. In her open letter slash op-ed, Manny describes, well, she decries the appropriation of black female culture. The piece is called Dear White Gays, Stop Stealing Black Female Culture. So there's been a flurry of responses and reactions to Manny's piece. I guess the most notable one was by Anthony D'Agostino in the Huffington Post. And his piece was called By Sierra, A Slightly Angry Queer Response to the Sierra Manny Controversy. Mm. And his piece is also being critiqued for its underlying white privilege. Now, I'm just going to read out a few key excerpts of her piece that I believe highlight and illustrate her main points. So basically, she starts off with, I don't care how well you can quote Medea, who told you that your booty was getting bigger than hers, how cute you think it is to call yourself a strong black woman, who taught you to twerk, how funny you think it is to call yourself Keita or Keisha, or for which black male you've been bottoming. You are not a black woman, and you do not get to claim either blackness or womanhood. It is not yours. It is not for you. A culture of racism is bad enough, but pairing it with patriarchal structures that intend to undermine women's advancement is like double-fisting bleach in acid rain. At the end of the day, if you are a white male, gay or not, you retain so much privilege. What is extremely unfairly denied you because of your sexuality could flow back to you if no one knew that you preferred the romantic and sexual company of men over women. And here the difference is that the black woman with whom you think you align so well, whose language you use and stereotypical mannerisms you adopt, cannot hide their blackness and womanhood to protect themselves the way that you can hide your homosexuality. To claim that you're a minority woman just for the sake of laughs, and to say that the things allowed her or the things enjoyed by her are done better by you, isn't cute or funny. First of all, it's aggravating as hell. Second, it's damaging and perpetuating of yet another set of aggressions against us. Claiming our identity for what's sweet without ever having to taste its sour is not. Breathing fire behind ugly stereotypes that reduce black females to loud caricatures for you to emulate isn't sweet either. So that is basically just a few key excerpts of her article, just to get a sense of the gist of it. And I'm just going to have an open forum discussion right now. Everybody's chomping at the bit to
biting their lips
to chime in. So yeah, initial thoughts, comments, reactions.
I feel like Tamara's going to burst. So
I know. I'm not good at hiding it at all. Oh my goodness. If I had a nickel for every time some of my, you know, gay white friends are like, well, you know, like, it's the same struggle. Like, I would have a week-long inclusive, like, in the Caribbean. I really would. I would, like, straight be, like, in Punta Cana or who the heck knows where. Actually, now I almost wish I did get, like, a nickel for every time. You know, it's interesting, you know, that this idea, like, I definitely understand where she's coming from, that idea of, well, you know, like, some of my best friends are gay people as well, and I wouldn't want to presume to, you know, play with how they're living. Like, I think I've often asked myself that question, like, oh, what's that connection about? And, you know, between the, you know, the gay community and black women, like, so many icons are these awesome black women, like Chaka Khan and, well, everybody, right? Like, you know, and I get that sense of relating on the level of struggle and admiring overcoming that struggle, but it's like, bless you, Audre Lorde, like, truly, there is no hierarchy of oppression here. Like, we don't have to have an oppression Olympics, you know. That D'Agostino piece, I don't know who he was writing that to, but I got to say, it sure was not Sierra. I was like, honey, maybe you are writing to, like, Cookie Carter with her evangelical show on basic cable, Cookie Carter.
Pia Glenn's the best, by the way. Sidebar. But I mean, it just seems like one of those typical things. It's like, it's great to admire and emulate, but there is a difference between appropriation and admiration. Mm-hmm. Culture, like, I'm so down to share culture. Like, please, enjoy my culture. Enjoy my food. Enjoy my music. What do you have? I'm into it. Not so into it. That's fine. That's, like, I think exchange is great and healthy. But she's speaking to a really specific instance that sadly does happen. It may not be the whole of the experience, but it does happen. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I'm blacker than you. It's just like, yeah, well, let's see who gets followed in the store. You or me.
Reality check.
Yeah. Same point.
That bitter and the sweet comment that she made is really, it's very striking, you know, to me. I mean, we don't choose who we love. And quite frankly, you know, regardless of your skin color or your creed or your beliefs or whatever, like everybody, your gender, everybody could be ignorant. Like it's not, I mean, we can talk about homophobia, you know, in the black community, but like every community has it, you know, because people are jerks. Like people can be such jerks. But I don't know, like... Mm-hmm. It's the, I mean, all of what we do, like our gender, our culture, it's all a performance anyway. We perform our femininity every day when we get out the door. Exactly. You know, like if I put on makeup, well, like for an audition, I don't normally, but like, you know, I put on the makeup and the dress and perform my femininity. It's like, how different is it from if a dude wants to do it? Mm-hmm. Not really.
And I guess that leads us to, I guess, our next point, our next question really, which is that, I personally was a little bit uncomfortable with some of the phrasing of what she said about you do not get to claim either blackness or womanhood. I guess I was a little bit uncomfortable with how it was framed, because for the most part it's a pretty gender normative statement to make in some sense. But also I think there's a lot of, and my understanding, or maybe just is the fact that gender is a continuum, and there's a lot of performance and there's a lot of gender bending and stuff, in especially in the LGBTQ and trans communities. So there's a little bit of an underlying sort of mainstream bent to that. And the next question that I'm going to throw out, because we always need to talk about Bae, and it all comes back to Bae.
Oh, Lord God. She brought him up. She brought her up.
For the amount of time we've mentioned her on the show, we should be getting some, I don't know, it's something like, from
royalty
her.
Royalty.
Swag or something.
Yes.
Shout out on her next album.
Yeah, she just needs to ship some like Nutella down to the studio or something. I will take Nutella. Well, back to the question we keep asking again and again. Whose idea of black femininity or women of color femininity is being represented, right? Like, Beyonce doesn't represent me. I'm pretty sure she doesn't represent, you know, black women. And pretty sure she doesn't even represent Beyonce when she wakes up.
Check it out. Really, that's a character. Beyonce is playing a character.
Exactly. So that whole idea of you know, sort of this hyper-feminine idea that we keep coming back to.
Right, like the Agostino, like he was calling out on Bae being like, you know, she's defining black womanhood, but she's blonde, you know, what's the exchange going on there?
I just
wanted to share this quote that really spoke to me after like reading both articles and feeling the anger that was just seething out of it, and this like essentially like, you know, this like battle against like marginalized people, you know, who are clearly feeling victimized and stuff. It's by bell hooks. Yes, I have written about difference, but my overall belief is that solidarity comes from not overemphasizing our difference, but by looking at the ways in which we might have a shared vision of unity, of solidarity, of beloved community. So I think those two people need to like hang out a little bit,
have a beer,
hug it out, you know, because it's like, how many of your friends have come up and done a stereotypical version of like, hey girl, like, you know what I mean? It's not a gay thing, it's not a anything thing, it's just you get kind of close,
yeah,
and feel like a
thing to do, nothing gain, nothing tried, very few even try, most just wanna get high, from the cradle to the grave.